Hello and welcome to Affable Chat. My name is Benjamin, and my usual co-host Joey is busy dealing blackjack in Atlantic City. So instead, I've brought in a guest. Today we're joined by Corey from He's Done It, a mostly sports podcast. Corey, welcome back to Affable Chat.
Thank you for having me back on. I know I've made a lot of appearances over the years, but this is only my third movie review and the first since 2019. So this is long overdue. Excited to be talking about a movie instead of just your classic off script. So,
and we're happy to have you, Corey. And we brought you here today because we're talking about Ocean's 11.
Mr. Ocean, what we're trying to find out is, was there a reason you chose to commit this crime? Or was there a reason you simply got caught this time?
My wife left me. I was upset. I got into a self-destructive pattern.
If released, is it likely you'd fall back into a similar pattern?
She already left me once. I don't think she'd do it again just for kicks.
Mr. Ocean, what do you think you would do if released?
This is an American ensemble cast heist comedy directed by Steven Soderbergh. The cast includes the fantastic Mr. Fox, Jimmy Lunchbox, Billy Bean, Trapper John McIntyre, Barish Pash, Danny Williams, Mickey Duca, The Amazing Yen, a writer from The Dick Van Dyke Show, Good Will Hunting, Vincent Mancini, Aaron Brockovich, Al G. Rhythm, and Eric Foreman. I watched this movie on Max. Corey, how did you watch it?
I also watched this movie on Max.
That's right. It's just Max now.
Yes, just Max. Yeah, I've emphasized on that. I would have cut you off if you used those three letters.
We would
not
have been just
say anymore.
Confused. Yeah, it's right. Like, what? What platform? Right. All right. Before we begin our analysis of this film, we will succinctly summarize the events in our special 60-second synopsis. If you'd like to skip the synopsis, just scrub ahead 60 seconds right now. Professional thief Danny Ocean is finally released from prison after a 4-year stint. While he was in the clink, his wife Tess divorced him. As soon as he's free, he starts to round up his buddies to pull the ultimate job, robbing the Bellagio, the Mirage, and the MGM Grand all at once. Legally, the casinos must have enough cash available to cover all their patrons' bets, which means that on the night of an upcoming high-profile boxing event, the casinos will hold over $150 million in an unbreakable underground vault.
The casinos are owned and operated by Terry Benedict, a ruthless businessman that likes to know everything that goes on in his casinos at all times. Danny and his team of professional crooks concoct an elaborate scheme in which they each use their individual talents to swindle, confuse, and misdirect Terry and his staff in order to get to the money. Everyone is motivated for their singular goal, but there's one thing Danny didn't mention. Terry is dating his ex-wife Tess.
In the climax of the heist, Danny's best friend Rusty calls Terry and tells him that he's being robbed. When Terry calls the cops, it's actually Rusty and the rest of the crew that respond dressed as a SWAT team. They load the money into bags and literally walk out of the casino unscathed.
Danny taunts Terry about getting robbed, then gets Terry to reveal that he cares more about the money than Tess. Tess is watching this unfold on one of the casino's cameras, and she realizes that she can no longer be with Terry. She rushes out of the casino to witness Danny being arrested for violating his parole. 3 to 6 months later, she's waiting for him outside prison as he's released. Little do they know, they are being followed by Terry's men.
The end. All right, there you have it. The events of Ocean's 11. Before we get into our conversation on this film, Corey, I want to know, why did you pick this film out of all the films you could have picked to discuss today on Affable Chat?
Yes, that is a great question. I could give a very succinct answer to this, but there's so much that goes into it, and I want to take the time to really kind of provide all the context that went into you and I choosing to review Ocean's 11. And first of all, you originally texted me on like January 1st or 2nd, right at the beginning of the year when you were trying to plan out the Affable Chat calendar for all of 2024, which props to you, how you were able to pull that off is insane. But you had told me that there was going to be a week at the end of March where Joey would not be available, and you wanted me to come on as a guest co-host, and I was all about it. I think initially there was an appeal to do something sports related because my podcast is a mostly sports podcast, and everything lined up pretty well with opening day. So initially I was like, we could do a baseball movie, but I just kept going back to being very salty about not being included on the Moneyball episode, which is my favorite baseball movie. As much as I like, you know, I think a movie like Bull Durham was one. I was like, yeah, I mean, that would be a good one to review. But when it came down to it, I was like, I couldn't be on Moneyball. I don't need to do another baseball podcast. So basically, I took, instead of a timing that makes sense to everybody, I did something that is very general to myself. And that is the fact that I am going to Las Vegas in just a few days after recording. And while it doesn't directly apply to you right now, you're busy with too many other things to join a trip out there. You and I have gone together, I think, 4 times now. And I know you've been at least 1 time without me. So this is a city that you and I are both very familiar with. We've had so many great moments and memories there over the years that I thought doing a Vegas movie would be a fun thing. And it's also like there's a lot of great films out there. So on my podcast, He's Done It, not as much recently, but in the past, we would historically do a top five countdown every episode. And before you, me, my co-host Brian, and several others all made a trip to Las Vegas in October, September 2021, we decided to count down our top five Las Vegas films. And at the time, there were two movies that I knew were going to be 1 and 2. I watched a few other movies just to kind of fill out the list on top of some others that I had seen before and was ready to watch. And Ocean's 11 was one of those movies. It fits in my category of one of my favorite movies ever, which is a movie I've seen once and exactly once that I remembered liking, but come back to years later, not really remembering everything about it, you know, be like, I know I enjoy this movie, but there's so many things that I'm going to rediscover and relearn. I kind of remember some scenes, some plot points, some of the actors, but more things are going to be discovered the second time through, especially when there's a decent gap in there. So, the top two movies that I have for Las Vegas are Casino, which is Martin Scorsese, 1995 film, Robert De Niro, Joe Pesci. It's about Ace Rothstein, who was a mafia type casino owner in Vegas in the 60s, 70s, early 80s, back when that was a thing. Great movie. I put Goodfellas above it, but like to me, that's like a quintessential Vegas movie. And then my other one is The Hangover, which, that's a fantastic, very funny movie. We didn't need to come on here and review it. Like, that's the kind of movie you just unplug your brain and watch for an hour and a half and just know you're going to have a lot of laughs. So
that movie owned its era, too. Like, when The Hangover came out, it was like, this is the comedy movie that is out right now.
Absolutely. Yeah. 2009 is like the very end of the 2000s, which I think was, in my opinion, the best decade for comedy movies. So, you know, it's, we did our comedy movie list, and The Hangover is definitely high on my personal list. So after that, it was just a matter of, okay, what's my third favorite movie about Las Vegas? And maybe it's Ocean's 11. You know, we're going to talk about it. You had thrown out Ocean's 11 as an idea. I threw out a couple other movies. Ultimately, the biggest tiebreaker was Ocean's 11 is on Max, and other movies are on sites that either streaming platforms that you and I don't both have, or you have to pay for them. So free kind of won out in this case. And I'll say, of all
or
the movies
free
that
or already paying for.
Yeah, right. Free or already paying for. Right. It's out of sight, out of mind kind of payment. So I think that of all the movies we could have chosen, it made so much sense to come back to Ocean's 11. And yeah, I mean, that's really the explanation here for why we're doing this movie.
Yeah. And I love that that's the pick. You are synonymous with Vegas in my mind, which is crazy because you don't even live there, but almost every time I'm there, you're there. So I think this movie just makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I go out there once a year, some years more than once, but I love going out there. I have a really good friend who lives out there, and so many people are like, oh, got to go to Vegas with Corey, and some of them love it enough that they keep going back and back. So it's definitely become an annual tradition with a lot of my friends in Raleigh, where we love to just get on the plane, fly out 5 hours, and just have the time of our lives out there. So.
Okay, so that's why we picked the movie. Let's get into it. We'll begin with our pros and cons. So, Corey, what did you like about Ocean's 11?
Yeah, and I think that's a great place to start. So just kind of going through my pros right off the bat, this movie rocks. Like, I love this movie. It's a movie, like I said, I saw it one time. I liked it more the second time than I did the first time. Like, I remember being like, yeah, this is a fun movie. I forgot just how fun it was. People magazine said pure fun from start to finish. Yeah, that's a great way to describe it. 10 out of 10, no notes, perfect review. I think, like, this movie, it's not like a best picture quality. This isn't Citizen Kane, but it doesn't try to be. There are other heist movies out there that they have this big focus on intense drama, thriller, action. This movie, they're just like, we're going to be a comedy. We're just going to have fun with it. And it's just a fun 2-hour movie. Every time things start to get serious, you're immediately hit with comedic relief. There are so many times where I genuinely laughed out loud watching this movie, which you don't think of with a movie like Ocean's 11. You're just George Clooney, Brad Pitt. It's just, that's not something that you necessarily expect. So to me, this is just a fun movie. I have other pros, but I'll let you kind of immediately respond to just that overall take.
I love that you started off by saying this movie rocks, because the first thing, every time I finish a movie for the podcast, I just set to writing, just pure train of thought, just you know, stream of consciousness from mind to paper. The first thing I wrote was, this movie rules. This is just so nice. Much fun. Yeah. And it is. It's just fun all the way through, and it doesn't take itself, it never takes itself too seriously, and right. just allows you to have a blast with the concept of the ultimate heist, yep. which I think is just, it's just really fun.
Yes, absolutely. It's a really fun movie. I think kind of getting more specific, obviously the whole Las Vegas thing, like this is, like you said, it's a city that's synonymous with me. It's naturally going to stand out more just for that reason. I love a good ensemble cast. This one, I mean, it's the ultimate ensemble cast. You have just all these A-list actors. The two lead men were in their primes, like multiple time People Magazine Sexiest Man of the Year running the show. Julia Roberts was the most... highest paid actress in Hollywood at the time. And it's just all of like the lower cast members, they're still big names. You see them like, oh yeah, I know that person. I love the ensemble cast nature. I think that when I think of Las Vegas musically, I'm sure most people will instantly come to Viva Las Vegas. I mean, that's just the city's anthem, which I will say 6 years later, those lyrics still describe that city perfectly. It's crazy just how Elvis did it then. I'm like, yeah, this is like how I feel about it now. But I like that their intro to Vegas, basically when they got everyone assembled, they're like, all right, we're in Vegas now, was a little less satisfaction. Or yeah, a little less conversation. So yes, a little less conversation by Elvis is the intro as they go into Las Vegas. And I thought it was like a great song choice there. Overall, the soundtrack is like, eh, but I did like the musical score, you know, the orchestral aspect. I thought they did a good job with that. I really enjoyed the montages. So in particular, you have the opening one where, right, opening, I say, when Ruben is explaining about the three most successful previous attempts. I thought that was really fun just going through them. You know,
yes, and they did such a great job of taking you back in time. They played a song from each era, and everybody, they'd emphasize kind of the outfits of the common people in Vegas. I just thought it was a great salute to like kind of the decades as they were experienced in Vegas.
Right, because it was 60s, 70s, and 80s. So they did a good job of kind of breaking them down. And I love how it ended with the Caesar's Palace. He came, he grabbed, gunshots, they conquered. I thought that was just a great quote by Ruben. So that was one of them. Just the assembling of the crew members. It's a longer montage. It might be a loosely describing it, but just kind of going through every single one, kind of showing what they do, kind of how they're going to fit into the scheme, what their specialties are. And then finally, the very, very long montage, which like montages within montages, was just going through the whole setup, being like, this is how we're going to do this. First task, reconnaissance. Second task, power. Third task, surveillance. Fourth task, construction. Fifth task, intelligence. Sixth task, transport. And just, it was long, but I liked how they kind of did that. It just felt like very sorted, and it was easy to follow and keep up with. And they had so much fun the whole time doing it. So That's definitely big for me. And then I think like the final pro on top of so many other pros, I don't want to go on forever here, but I really enjoyed that scene where all of the crew members after completing the heist were standing around the Bellagio fountain, just one by one looking at them before they all part ways. I thought that was really cool. The Bellagio fountain is one of, if not the most iconic things about at least the Las Vegas Strip, maybe just short of the Las Vegas, Welcome to Las Vegas sign. So definitely really enjoyed that moment in terms of a final ode to Las Vegas.
It's so iconic. The first time I went to the Bellagio fountain, my mind took me right back to Ocean's 11.
Yeah.
It's to me, they're inseparable. This is the fountain from Ocean's 11. And I love that too. And you're talking about the kind of crewing up sequence where they're going and getting each individual guy. To me, the Ocean's 11 film is a quintessential heist movie. And it's, I'm not sure if you've seen the Rick and Morty episode about heists, but it's like inspired by Ocean's 11, and they have like the bit where everybody who joins the heist is like, you son of a bitch, I'm in. And that's really what it is. Everybody just deciding, you know what, I'm in, after like a short intro that kind of shows you how they're cool. And then you just get so excited to see all those people collaborate. And I really agree with basically everything you've said here, Corey. Like, this cast is so star-studded. When you just look at the promotional stuff that shows up when you search this movie on Max, if you had never heard of this movie before, you'd be like, what? They've got, right? First of all, Brad Pitt and Clooney, like you said, it's like two A-list lead men in their prime, but then you just have like Matt Damon's just, I'm also here, you know, and then Don Cheadle's basically an afterthought when he has that leading man, you know, kind of stature as well. And then you just go down this roster, and even guys that you don't necessarily come into the movie knowing show up in a way, they're well utilized in a way that I find just super impressive. The movie's full of witty dialogue. It's funny. It's the camera work also I thought was really intentional and interesting to look at. There's so many shots that are like, oh, that was just cool. Like, if you remember, just one example was when Linus is being the representative from the Nevada Gaming Commission, and they're about to start talking to Frank, but then they're like, maybe we should talk like not out on the floor, and they kind of walk out of the frame as the camera's zooming into them, and the camera just zooms beyond them into the elevator where you see the Mormon twins like wheeling the cart out, and you can see their clothes on the floor, and it's like, ah, that was all just one shot. That's awesome. And the movie's full of stuff like that.
Yeah, great cinematography for sure. And it's something I don't pick up on that as easily, I think, as someone who doesn't do this regularly. So I'm glad that you were able to call that out. But I mean, that is a great point, just the way you describe that. Also, the Molloy twins, not the Mormon twins.
Oh, the Molloy. I heard Mormon. Yes. I didn't watch with subtitles.
I mostly know it from just reading like the Wikipedia cast description. So,
well, they were in Utah, so it may have been a little bit of a suggestion to my brain. But Steven Soderbergh, it did such a great job of being intentional with the way that these sequences play out, so that it's not only informational in like a really compact way, but also really clear, or fun to look at while being clear. So I thought that was fantastic. It features Vegas as a setting in a really powerful way. It's the reason we're doing this right now. It's a Vegas movie, and that's really powerful. There's a love story here that I think is kind of the emotional heart of the film. It's not super deep, but it is there, and it gives you something satisfying. I think when you have a third act in a heist movie, you're expecting them to get out with it. You're looking for the twist, but you're expecting them to succeed. So you need that extra layer, I think, to really bring it home. And I think that Danny and Tess do enough to give us something to say, okay, this is still a story about people. This is a story about love. And I think that's great, as well as a bunch of mini arcs that some of our other members of the crew go through that I thought was just really impressive to be able to pull off in a movie with this many characters. Terry Benedict is a good villain and a worthy opponent for our impressive crew of Danny Ocean's 11. You know, they're they're all awesome in their own way and basically unstoppable, but you can still set up a villain where you're like, okay, maybe this guy's too powerful for right. even their combined like powers.
Yeah, and can we also yeah. talk about how good of a name Terry Benedict is for a Las Vegas casino owner? Like, I thought they absolutely nailed it with that. Because like, you think Benedict, you know, they kind of just, I think back to Benedict Arnold or Eggs Benedict or like something, you're like, oh, this is like an old timey thing. And then Terry on its own, not really, but together it just, it flows. I don't know what it is. I just like Terry Benedict. Yes, absolutely. That is a good name for the villain in this.
Yes. So. And the way that he's just so consistent and just he's a machine. I thought they built him up really well to be an interesting antagonist for our characters. So, yeah, a lot of great stuff going right. for this movie.
Well, they do a good job of kind of humanizing him too, as well. Like when he's initially meeting Danny, you can tell like there's a little bit of reservation, but also trying to be friendly and engaging in a non-friendly way, if you will. So yes. I do think that helps with it. So
yeah, and again, they do so much with so little. If you just like pay attention to the scene between Danny and Tess, it's just right back and forth, revealing so much without having to say so much. Like their backstory is kind of explained to you at light speed in just a short conversation between each other, and then Terry shows up, they're out of there, and you're right back to heist film. Yep. You know, and that's, I think, really well done. So, okay, I don't want to get too sucked in because we're going to talk about a lot of the great qualities of this, but let's talk about what we didn't like. Corey, what are your cons for Ocean's 11?
Yeah, so I didn't have very many cons for this movie. There's obviously, you know, little things you can kind of nitpick here and there, but I think the one big con that stands out that I believe is a universal con for this movie is Don Cheadle's British accent. Like it is panned as one of the worst British accents ever. Immediately, the first thing he says is, "All right, chaps, hold on to your knickers." And it's just like, all right, what? And there was no point to it. He just decided, you know what? I'm going to give my character a British accent. His agent was like, yeah, that's pretty good. And every time he talks about it, he's like, yeah, no, that sucked. I sacked my agent. I don't know why she said that it was good. He says that all of his London friends say it's a truly terrible London accent. So like, it is very widely panned. And also, I don't know that you really had a great point to it. So there's the one time where he comes out of the sewer and he says, oh, we're in Barney. And the guys are like, what? Barney Rubble? We're in trouble.
Yeah.
I assume that's a British thing, but like, I don't know. There's so many other comedic moments that I guess like you kind of work with it. But that to me was the only thing where it's like, yeah, okay, that's a British thing that Don Cheadle's character is doing here.
I thought it was funny. I also agree it's a bad accent, but I know that they were going for kind of this international feel to the team. You've got the amazing Yen, right. who doesn't even speak English.
Yes, he's purely Chinese.
Yeah, but I agree. The accent is forced.
Yeah. Okay. And then the other thing, I don't know. I don't have a great explanation for this. I appreciate and like horse racing. The Greyhound racing scene just made me uncomfortable. I don't know if it's just dogs. I feel bad, I guess. I don't really have an explanation. It's just, for whatever reason, I can watch a Kentucky Derby where actual humans are hitting and abusing horses to make them run faster. I'm like, yeah, that's normal. Horses like to run. And I see dogs running. I'm like, this just reminds me of bad things that people do to dogs. I don't have a great explanation outside of that. It's a con. I wish it was a horse track instead of a Greyhound track where they met Saul, but I mean, that's kind of where I'm at for a con, just something to kind of stand out here. So
Fair enough. I actually have something to say about that scene, but I'll save it for a little bit later. We'll stick to cons for now.
Sure.
For me, the biggest thing that sticks out in this movie is that this movie fails the Bechdel test hard. There are basically no women in this movie.
Yep. Yes, no, that's fair. Yep.
They definitely do not talk to each other or talk about anything besides men. So. Right. It's a guy's film, and it
is
almost,
definitely a dude's film. Yeah,
and I'm not just saying that because Ocean's 8 came out, or you know, it's Julia Roberts obviously looms large in this film, and she does a great job. But this movie is very much like a guy's movie, and it's why it is what it is. So that's something that I felt was very obvious to me on this watch around, that it was basically everyone's a dude. It doesn't matter whether they're the enemy or one of the team members. I mean, Ocean's 11 has no women in it.
Yeah,
team.
Yes, that is a great call out. It is just a bunch of dudes. Like, there are other heist like films where you do have women on that side of the thing, but no, in this, it's you just have the love interest, and that's it.
And the Bechdel test is kind of a meme in itself. I think because this is a remake of a movie that came out, I think, in the 60s.
In 1960.
So it's like you're working with something that was originally happening in an era where it was even more to the like direction of like men are everything in all of society. So it's kind of a meme, but it's also very true. This movie fails the Bechdel test. Also, this movie, for as much as I love that it's lighthearted fun, it is a bit surface level. This movie does not ask you to think deeper, and there's not much to go off of. I will say that what they say about in this like line of work, you have to stay focused. You mess up for 1 second, and then somebody gets hurt. I feel like there is something to that. I was at work focusing on something hard, and I like made a mistake that almost could have been bad. I was thinking, oh man, what would Danny Ocean say to me if he saw me slacking like this? So there's a little bit there, but in general, this movie doesn't really have a lot to go to think about after, besides, wow, that was a lot of fun.
That's totally fair. I say it is a great movie for that reason, but it also, like, it's they're not trying to be Citizen Kane, they're not trying to be this like Oscar winning picture, they're just trying to be a fun movie,
right,
where you just turn your brain off and be like, ah, yeah, Vegas heist movie. And yeah,
It's the type of thing that would keep me from letting this movie be my best movie
ever.
It's like it has a ceiling, which is pure fun, but then beyond, it doesn't really go that far beyond that.
Yeah, good point. It executes what it wants to be, but what it wants to be is inherently holding itself back.
Sure. When you're talking about what this medium is capable of.
Right.
And in the similar sense, I think that our characters, while fun and impressively fleshed out for this movie's runtime and the amount of characters in it, there's not that much to anybody in particular. I also think Danny is a bit of a Gary Stu. Like, he kind of can't fail. Like, even in the moments where it seems like he's messing up, which is when Tess is involved, he actually says, he's like, no, I have a plan. And he does, and it works perfectly.
Right.
So it's like, okay, this guy just can't be stopped. Which is also, again, kind of the appeal to Ocean's 11. It's fun when you can put a plan together and it goes according to plan, even though some of the other crew members do have their difficulties that they have to overcome, things that don't go to plan. And then I do think that there are some parts of the heist that are a little bit convenient, and we'll get into that a little bit later. So those are our pros and our cons. Let's move on to our overall section. And I want to start by asking some of the questions we ask all our guests as to how the film relates to you. So what about this movie speaks to you personally, Corey?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think the obvious thing is going to Las Vegas, but really kind of taking it further. So one thing that you and I and some of our friends started doing was having one night where we dress up in suits or whatever, nice fancy attire, go out to a nice steakhouse and really kind of have that good Vegas look. It's not just walking around in t-shirts and maybe a Hawaiian or two. Like, we're really kind of dressing the part to be in a casino-like environment. And when we went on that large trip, there were 10 of us who went to Vegas. We added another guy who lives there. So there were 11 of us all dressed up going to a restaurant. So it was, instead of Ocean's 11, it was Novotny's 11. So that's something I always think about, is just tying those two things together. So
that is so cool. I wish we had like hammered that home a little bit more while we were doing it, because you're so right. Like, a guy's trip in general and a guy's trip to Vegas more specifically is, I feel like, from our background, having seen this movie when we were younger, is just inherently us role-playing Ocean's 11.
Yeah.
You have the scheme
that
comes together. Like, Corey, he's the guy who knows how to get, like, a good deal on group rates for hotels, you know? And then we've got, you know, Anthony, he's really good at blackjack. And then, you know, Kuz, who knows how to get a breakfast stromboli at any hotel on the strip. You know, like, you've got your whole roster of guys in the crew. That's awesome.
yeah, of course. And we never got a pick with all of us together, but we got enough large picks that it was like, okay, I see the vision here. I definitely got at least one comment to me saying Novotny's 11. I was like, I wish that I had thought of that a few days earlier, but yes, you're right. That exactly.
I'm hearing is we have a reason to make Novotny's 12 and then Novotny's 13.
Right.
So we still got two more chances to get that photo. Okay. So kind of in the same realm, what does this movie remind you of in your life or in other media?
Yeah, I mean, I think in your life, it's the easy answer is you and I went to an escape room that was heist-themed in Atlanta just a month ago. So that's very fresh in my mind right now. Yes, we did a heist escape room. It was the Terry Benedict in this case. I don't remember the guy's name, but he was a...
Me neither. They didn't do a good job of building up the story.
Right. He was a museum curator who stole a Monet painting, and we had to get the Monet painting out. And it was fun. That was the first time I'd ever done an organized escape room like that. And you had described it as Ocean's 11. I think it was a heist. It was just any heist. It wasn't Vegas.
I wanted
it
to be Ocean's 11 so bad.
Right. I did like that. So that was a real life thing. And then I think in terms of other medium, so there are, I guess, a few things that stand out, and all of them were done post Ocean's 11. So the first one is I recently watched an episode of South Park that was Ocean's 11 themed, and basically the Obama McCain campaign was a secret cover up to them doing some type of heist. I don't remember the full details. It was like someone, I was hanging out with friends and they put on this episode randomly. My bigger takeaway was like, man, like this was what people were thinking about in terms of like, oh, the country's falling apart, the world's gonna end with Obama and McCain, and knowing where we are now with some of the discourse around our recent elections. But that was one thing. It was very directly Ocean's 11 inspired. Beyond that, two other heist movies kind of stand out. One is The Town, which doesn't have any direct actors in both of them, but that stars Ben Affleck. So this movie has Matt Damon, who of course is his counterpart in Good Will Hunting and other Boston movies, and then Casey Affleck, his brother. So that was a good tie together. This was kind of a Boston equivalent in the sense that instead of robbing a casino in a comedy, they rob a bank and they rob Fenway Park, and it's like, you know, very action thriller, real murder, all that stuff, like very Boston. And then the last one is the movie Now You See Me, a magician movie, came out in 2013. I was a big fan of Now You See Me, hated the twist at the end, but that was another one. It's very fun until like the very ending for me. But the first thing that they do as an act is they're in MGM Grand, one of the hotels involved here in Las Vegas, and they steal money from the Credit Republican Bank in Paris. And it involves a whole vault scene and everything. So I was like, yeah, that's kind of very similar to what happens in Ocean's 11, except it's the Bellagio vault instead. So.
Right. And they did such a good job of this movie that it really does echo through a lot of other media culture. Like we said, this is kind of the quintessential heist film. For me, what this movie reminds me of, or like how I kind of recognize it in my life, is, and I've heard this said by other movie reviewers, is that heist movies are all an analog for filmmaking. Like you have your different specialized members of the crew that come together to execute on the plan, you know, and making a movie, it works a lot in the same way. And Ocean's 11 has a lot of that as well. You kind of have Danny Ocean, the director, and then you've got maybe Rusty, who's your producer. Saul is maybe your lead actor, and all these different, you could even say Don Cheadle's character, what's his name?
Basher
is maybe he's the set designer because he has to, like, I don't know, or he does lights, you know, all that stuff. There's like a really good analog there as well, because it's such a collaborative effort to shoot a film. And so in a heist is all about collaboration. It's about being able to execute on a shared vision. And I think that that's really cool. It's one of the things that I love about movies is that it is possible to make one on your own, but you'll probably end up with something much more interesting if you let everybody do their specific job and create something that is greater. So,
That's a really interesting way to look at it. I hadn't really put two and two together, but it just in general, it's any type of project that comes together. But of course, when you're talking movies, a heist movie, it is kind of a, you know, the whole point of making a movie, you get all these people coming together, different roles and stuff. That's the same thing that's going on in this heist.
Oh, yeah. So. And, you know, as a genre, heist movies are seen as that kind of parallel to filmmaking, including the fact that you might not get away with it and you might go to prison because you might make a bad movie.
Right. Make no money, terrible reviews. Yes, very, very much consequences. So,
okay. Well, in general, Corey, when you're thinking about Ocean's 11, what themes are present that speak to you?
Yeah, so I guess I'm sure that there are a lot of different themes you can go off, but to me, I think the biggest theme that stands out is revenge. I mean, that's really the big thing. Danny Ocean is looking to get revenge on Terry Benedict, who for more or less stealing his ex-wife by stealing his money. But I think that it goes beyond just Danny, and I think one scene, or I guess one, you know, plot point in this really emphasizes it, is the initial encounter with Ruben, where he's going through being like, you guys are crazy, this is what happened when all these other guys tried to steal from a Las Vegas casino, it's not going to work out for you. And he says, just out of curiosity, what hotels are you, or casinos are you planning on robbing? And when they say Bellagio, MGM Grand, the Mirage, he puts it together, oh, that's Terry Benedict's. He sunk my own casino, the Xanadu, literally blew it up. And yeah, now I want to get in. Now I'm going to finance this. Now I'm going to make sure that we take down this guy. So I think that revenge is really a big thing. And it's something that I think personally, I don't know if I'm a very vengeful person. At least I don't think that I am, but I do kind of understand the whole concept. And like they say, revenge is a dish best cold revenge is a dish best served cold. I think this is a case where, you know, Danny could have just been focused entirely on Terry, but instead he was focused on Terry's money and just really kind of ruining this big thing that he built for himself.
So. Yeah, definitely. He's definitely motivated by revenge. And yeah, I don't know if I agree with the idea that you should pursue revenge, but I think this movie definitely lets you fantasize about that. And also says, if you're going to do it, you better have a good plan. You better think of everything if you want to pull it off, because seeking revenge is hazardous, definitely. You know, I guess for me, if I'm going to answer this question as well, I think this theme of priorities is in there, with Tess being kind of the object of affection between our protagonist and our antagonist. It really comes down to how those two show what matters to them. With Terry, it's clear. His casinos come first. He wants to know what's going on with them. He doesn't even want to kiss Tess if they're on camera, because he has to keep up appearances. Whatever his reasons are, it's not the best move for his business, so he doesn't want to do that. While we've got Danny, who gets sent to prison, and what I gathered, because they do it, there's a lot of reading between the lines and implied meaning in his conversations with Tess, but basically sounds like he didn't tell her that he was a thief. So that's why he was a thief and a liar. But then he said, I don't do that anymore. And she's like, like being a thief? He's like, no, being a liar.
Being a liar.
Now I'm going to be upfront with you. I am a thief, and I know what I'm doing. So he's saying that he prioritizes their relationship, or he expresses that he's prioritizing their relationship by putting Tess into the scheme. He sets it up to expose Terry's priorities to Tess, by doing that, he sentences himself to another stint in prison, kind of reversing the initial thing that broke them up. Because he went to prison, she didn't expect that. She divorced him, or at least like took her ring off, because she was like, oh, you care about crime more than me. That's why you let your, like, that's why this happened. You put yourself at risk. But now he's going the opposite direction, and he cares so much about expressing his love to Tess, he's willing to go back to prison.
Right. And I think that you can kind of look at it and say that as much as like the money is a big emphasis, I think that the money was maybe more to get others involved on his plan, where his priority was Terry no longer being with Tess, and then hopefully Tess going back to him.
Right. And they do such a great job with that scene. I'm like extremely impressed with this movie's efficiency, because that conversation between him and Tess tells you so. Honestly, I had trouble keeping up with it the first time. I watched this movie twice last week, to first time for the podcast, second time because I just loved it so much I wanted to watch it again. And there's that scene where they're talking, where they first run into each other in the film, where they're at dinner, where she first thinks he's Terry, it's 30 seconds late, but it's actually Danny. And after they finish their conversation, before it cuts away, because it's a regular just back and forth kind of shot where it's like her face, his face, they're just talking to each other. But then before they cut away, you see a shot of them from outside the restaurant through the window, and the window pane isolates each one of them on their own piece of glass, like visualizing the separation between the two of them, which I thought was awesome. Like that's such a good job, because that's really what they had established. At that point, Tess said, I've moved on. And Danny, you have to accept that. And he says, I can accept that, but just not Terry. You can't be with Terry. And so I thought they set it up so well, so quickly, and then moved on so we can get back to the epic heist stuff. So let's talk about Terry Benedict, you know, the ruthless businessman, the villain here. Does he deserve to be robbed? Is he a bad guy?
Yeah, I think he is a bad guy. I think it's fair to say he deserves to be robbed, mostly because I think it's clear that all he cares about is money and power. We talked about the whole Tess thing, choosing the money over her. Just the whole story when Linus and I forget who he's talking to, but two of them were just outside the casino. Linus's job in the whole pre-heisting was to basically just survey Terry and kind of figure out his every move, what he does. And he's saying that the last guy who cheated in his casino, which I don't know how much, you don't know how much he was doing. It could have been $10. He was just, you know, 100, maybe not even just like this big time winning. He not only does he just kind of get him in trouble within the casino, but he had his house foreclosed on and his brother-in-law's tractor dealership bankrupted. It's just, I mean, that's again, revenge. Like, there you go. He takes it, just expedites it so crazily, just over the top, just to say, I have all this power. I can do all this. I think he's someone who needed to be humbled and say, hey, you might have, by accounts of Danny and Rusty, the most intricately designed vault system in the world, but it can still be taken. So I think it's fair to say he deserved to be robbed just because he's not a great person. So
yeah, I think I would agree with you there. I think one of the nice things about this movie is that it doesn't, like we said, it doesn't ever get too serious. Like, we have this team of criminals, or as Basher calls them, proper villains, but they're more in it for the love of the game. They like, obviously, they want to get paid a lot of money, but they're like, I'm good at whatever my skill is as it pertains to heists, not I am like a vicious murderer who has to make his money through heist because I'm an outlaw.
They're not killing people. They're just breaking into a casino and they're getting out, making sure like that no one really gets into any harm outside of these guys. So
right. And like robbing a casino, even on its face, is almost like a morally gray area, because it's a casino. The house always wins. People with gambling addictions go in there and get their lives ruined. So it's like, there are worse things that to steal from. Not to mention they have insurance, you know, whatever. Right. There's like, if you're really that concerned with the casino, it's not the end of the world for them. So I felt like that works in this movie's favor to keep it lighthearted fun.
Right, I agree. So if you just kind of going back to the town, when you're robbing a bank, you're talking about other people's money. In this case, you're talking about a casino. You're talking about, it was organized crime that was running this for so long before corporations got involved. And now it's just this, like you said, it's a very gray area. I think a lot of people are kind of like, this is weird, just the way that gambling has kind of been on the rise in recent years in America. So, I do think that it's one of those situations where, like you said, there are worse things you can rob, like than a casino. So,
right, and it's another example of that kind of moral gray area. When the lights go out and chaos ensues and people are like stealing, I don't feel bad. I'm like, this is hilarious. This is
I know,
this is good fun. So,
And I'll say, I did think it was a little over the top with like the whole boxing thing. Is like, I don't necessarily know why the lights going out just turned it into that kind of chaos outside of the fact that you just don't see it coming. You're like, we don't know how to react right now. I guess that's it. It did feel like that was a little over the top. But you know, that's
especially because it didn't seem like either of them tried to gain a competitive advantage in the dark. It was like, once the lights came back on, that's when
they're standing in the same spot.
It would be different if like the lights came back on and one of them was like wailing on the other one on the ground and had like gotten a cheap shot. So I agree, that was a little bit weird. But the chaos was fun. I didn't have any sort of thoughts about how I felt about Vegas maybe having some chips stolen while I was in the dark. So, okay, well, what about Tess? So, first of all, let's just talk about Tess a little bit. You know, Julia Roberts, the $20 million woman coming into this film at the height of her career. And I guess this was my takeaway immediately, because I kind of forgot Julia Roberts is in this movie.
Oh, yeah, same.
She's not, like, as relevant now. No. When you think of, like, A-list women, she doesn't, she's not first to come to mind.
No, not at all. I had the same exact thought, whereas, like, I don't think of Julia Roberts at all. And part of it is, this was 23 years ago. There are a lot more actresses these days that you do think of. But even there's so many, like, from her era that come to mind before Julia Roberts. But then it's also like, oh, this was, like you said, the top of her career. She was a $20 million highest paid actress in Hollywood. So it was a big deal for her at the time to be in this movie. And it was a big deal in the sense of, yeah, this is like just this hot actress that naturally men and women are going to look at in the same way you look at a George Clooney and a Brad Pitt.
Yes, exactly. She has that pedigree that matches those guys. And I completely agree with that. But one thing I'll say is that, first of all, Julia Roberts, like we said, obviously an attractive movie star.
Yes.
But she is not the drop-dead gorgeous, like, Vegas broad that the characters in this movie make her out to be when they're first describing her. Linus says that her walk past him is the best part
of his day. Best part of his day. Yeah.
And we get this dreamy walking sequence that, like, to me, just comes across as hilarious when you see Julia Roberts, like, it's like zoomed in on her and it's like half, like 50% opacity of her, like, walking down the stairs. And it's like quirky woman Julia Roberts with, like, a kind of weird hairdo just like bouncing around walking down the stairs. I thought it was so funny. It's not, it's clearly not intended to be funny.
No, not at all.
But it, to me, I was like, this is hilarious. I'm not calling her ugly. Obviously, Julia Roberts wouldn't be where she was at if she didn't have, if she wasn't gorgeous. But, and I'm not even saying she did a bad job in this movie, because I think she did. She brought that emotion across.
Yeah, I thought she was great just from a pure actress perspective. I thought she did a great job portraying Tess.
Definitely, especially when she's the only woman who has really any screen time at all.
Right.
She represents well, but I just thought the contrast between the language of cinema trying to portray her as this smoke show and what we see, I thought, was comedy in my eyes, which, again, I know I could come across bad, but what, I think I've expressed myself well here. Yep. It was funny to just see her be like, I'm the hot, you know, Vegas broad here. But anyways, Tess, she is the object of two different men's affection in this film. Do you agree with her choice to get back with Danny at the end?
So I think the easy answer is I agree with her choice to leave Terry. I think that anyone after seeing that he chose the money over her or would choose the money over her given the option, obviously she should have left him. I've been back and forth on this because I don't know that Danny really does a whole lot to necessarily justify that he is not the same person that she originally left. I know the whole idea is he was a liar and a thief. Now he's just a thief, but he's going to tell the truth. But then he immediately goes to prison for another 3 to 6 months. Is that a life that he's going to continue to live? Is that something that she should continue to want to go through? I don't know. I think it's clear that Danny still loves her. I also think that it's clear that she still has a lot of feelings for him and still has that love for him as much as he hurt her, which I think is, you know, obvious in the does Terry make you laugh? No, she didn't say no. She just says, He doesn't make me cry.
Yes.
Which I think kind of implies he doesn't make her laugh either. But yes, I think it's one of those things where it makes sense just in the end that George Clooney is going to get the girl and that Danny Ocean's going to get the girl. I have not seen either Ocean's 12 nor Ocean's 13, so I don't necessarily know how this story continues to play out. But it feels like one where there's going to continue to be some problems in this relationship, that it's not just all lovey-dovey, like they're perfect for each other. Because ultimately, I would think that the kind of woman who would be most successful with a thief heist organizer is someone who also participates in, that, you know, like the whole Bonnie and Clyde type relationship. And that's not what we have here.
does this movie make you want to watch Ocean's 12 and Ocean's
13? Yes, 100%. Like, I need to watch Ocean's 12 and Ocean's 13 as soon as I have the opportunity
I feel the same way. And when I was younger, I watched Ocean's 11 multiple times. I only watched Ocean's 12 and 13 like once, and I honestly don't remember a thing. I'm a little nervous based on what people say about them, but that's why you watch the movie yourself, so you can judge that.
Right.
So I'm hopeful, but it's what I've heard also is that if Ocean's 11 is a movie, like it's an analog for making a movie, Ocean's 12 is an analog for making a sequel and the struggles that come with like following up a big hit. So,
right.
Yeah. And I think you're right. I don't think there's a whole lot there for Danny to really win Tess back, unless Tess is so shallow that she's like, well, he has $13 million now, you know, but she doesn't express that.
She doesn't.
I think there's a lot of heavy lifting being done by previous relationship experience together, right? They were married. So there's something there.
Right.
And Danny Ocean has been implicated in a bunch of other crimes. So the implication is that he's a very experienced criminal. It's very possible that they've been together for a very long time, and it's really just this is a blip in their relationship as opposed to like a total fracture and needing more than just, hey, this guy you're currently with is bad. You know, just proving that he's bad could be enough to get her back, but a lot of the stuff off screen is doing a lot of heavy lifting there, which is kind of unsatisfying.
Yeah, right. We don't necessarily know the full timeline of their marriage. Like, I don't think it's stated how long they were together before he went off to prison. All we know is that he went to prison.
And they just got married because he's like wearing a suit and like a tuxedo, and he only had his wedding ring on him when he went to prison.
What if they got
married right before?
Right.
But if Tess is just his current floozy and he's like not even, although now maybe he's changed his ways in prison, wants to be with one person forever, but we just don't know. Right
Yeah, there's a lot of things that are unclear, which is why it's such an open-ended response, like an answer to should she have taken him back. It's you don't know enough of the context to really understand it. You just know that he lied to her, and now he's saying he's not going to lie, but he's going to continue to live his life of crime. So,
right.
You know, have
he's
fun
not
with
retiring.
That.
Yeah. So it's like,
no.
I could, if somebody rolls their eyes and is like, come on, Tess, you can do better than Danny, I would be like, that's valid. I think you can definitely say that.
Right. And it's also one of those things where you can say, you can do better than Danny. But again, you're like, this is George Clooney. This is prime George Clooney. Like, yeah, get back together with him. Hope for the best. Like, why not?
It is prime George Clooney. This is triple double every night George Clooney.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, speaking of George Clooney, he's got the whole crew together, and there's a lot of guys to like here. So out of all the members of the gang, who's your favorite, Corey?
Yeah. And I think it's, in some ways, I think it's hard not to say Danny just as a leader. He's the guy who stands out. He gets the most screen time. You learn the most about his story. And again, it's George Clooney. Like, I don't blame anyone for saying him. But I think the hard thing with this is all of these guys in this crew are criminals. They're all like bad people. It's to various extents. Some of them just join in and like this is their first crime. But I think that the character who I found myself liking more and more as the movie got on, to the point where I say confidently he's my favorite, is Linus, played by Matt Damon. He comes in, he's the 11th member. He's just kind of like this, I view him as this young person who's just kind of in the crew just to be in the crew. And then he slowly plays a bigger role. You know, we see him trying to get a little too into it when he's the one who gets left in the back of the van while the, you know, Turk and Virgil Malloy are going back and forth, like playing 20 questions. Am I a man? Yes. 19. Am I alive? Yes. 18. Evil Knievel. Shit. Just like that. He's dealing with them. They're like fighting each other, being very childish and brotherly. And then he escapes. Ends up in the building, has to be saved. But I think that kind of shows, okay, like he's trying to get really involved. And I thought his role as the Las Vegas Gaming Commission, like that really kind of set the stage. Then he ends up being the one who's in the vault with Danny, where they're kind of dangling from the wires, waiting for the power to go out so they can get down, cutting off the security lasers. So yeah, I think that Linus is someone who, you know, as the movie went on, he became my favorite member of the gang.
I like that selection a lot, and I applaud your bravery to not default to Danny. Linus is super interesting. As if you look at this movie as a trilogy, this is like the origin story for Linus. Everybody else is kind of already established and has a history, but Linus is the up and comer.
He's a new guy.
Yeah, his father is like this criminal that everybody knows. The implication there is that he was really impressive. People expect a lot from his son, but he's unproven. He's the best pickpocketer that Danny's ever seen, so that's already high praise. But he wants to build his own legacy. He doesn't want to live in his father's shadow. And again, it's like they express that so quickly. You're like, oh, I get this guy, and I know what I want from this guy as a character. And he has his opportunity to step in. Danny's out, Linus is in. And then, like you said, they end up being on the wire together. They're kind of partnered up there in like the vault portion of the heist. It's just awesome. And Linus is one of the reasons that makes me want to continue watching the other two movies, is because I want to see what happens to him.
Right, because you know that he's going to have a lot of growth. It's Matt Damon, so obviously he's going to get a bigger and bigger role. Like, he's one of the names on the poster. They could go with anybody. He's the one who joins your Brad Pitt, George Clooney, Julia Roberts. So I think that I'm excited to see what happens with Linus as he becomes more prominent in this whole thing.
It's funny that like we're sitting here speculating on the sequels of Ocean's 11, yes, which have been out for
Out with, 2004.
So if I'm going to answer this question, I do think I'm going to go the same way. It's more interesting to not say Danny Ocean. I'm actually going to go with Saul. Saul is the character I think that I liked the most, especially on this rewatch. Saul Bloom is his name. And it's because I felt like I understood him in a new way this time watching it. So Saul is a experienced criminal. He's very experienced. He's the most experienced. He's been around the longest.
Yep.
And it's clear that he hasn't achieved that much. He's risked it all. He's gambled a lot on a life of crime, and he's ended up with more or less an average retirement in Florida.
Right. Yep.
You know, he's at the dog track and still gambling there, you know, maybe even because he's still looking to hit it big. He hasn't, it wasn't that successful. I guess he didn't get caught, so that's good, but he hasn't had, that kind of big score like he ends up with in this movie. But he's at the dog track and he bets on a dog that breaks late. And I thought this was really interesting because the film, it's a little bit unclear what they're even talking about. Rusty kind of leans over to tell him about the heist without letting us listen in. But the only thing we really hear him talk about is what bet he makes. And he bets on this dog that is supposed to be at its best near the end of the race. And I think this is a perfect parallel for Saul's life. He's gone through this whole life where evidently he did not succeed very much, but then his final performance is part of Ocean's 11's heist, where he does incredible. He does it all in his acting. He becomes this Russian guy. He fools everybody
to
fool.
Lyman Zurga's German.
Oh, German guy.
Yeah.
And dies. he's so good at acting that he's able to fake his own death and even be able, presumably a part of the SWAT team that goes down the elevator shaft.
You do see him in there. You see him lift up his helmet. It's like, all right, this old guy who clearly should not be doing this.
That's not going to give anything away. Yeah. But I just thought that was so interesting. It's like they set it up at the very beginning. They say Saul is going to, he's the dog that breaks late. He's going to do his best in the twilight of his career. And that comes through. So that's why, I think that's why Saul is the last one to leave the fountain. Because for everybody else, it's like, we did great. This is awesome. For Saul, this is the pinnacle moment of his life. It's all led up to this. And he finally hit the jackpot. He finally hit the big time. His genius is finally recognized and rewarded. So that's why Saul is my favorite member of the crew.
Yeah, so that break late comment, I caught it at the time. I'm glad that you put it like that. It definitely gives me a greater appreciation for the Greyhound racing. So I was initially going to make Saul an honorable mention, but I was like, let me hold off and see if you go with him first. So I'm glad, like, as soon as you said Saul, I was like, yes, I love that, because Saul was going to be my answer, and then I initially decided I was just going to go with Linus. So Saul, I think for me, as the movie went on, I gained an even greater appreciation for him. And like earlier, you're talking about it. He's just like this basically failed con man who's like not failure, but not super successful, just a retiree living in Florida, trying to get by. You know, his doctor says he needs more vitamins. He's got a nice girl, whatever. He's like content with his life, but you can tell he's not really. And then he ends up playing this hugely prominent role as Lyman Zerga. And none of this could have happened without him being able to infiltrate with Terry. So
yes,
yeah, big fan of Saul in this one.
He's fantastic. I want to quickly run through the rest of the crew just because I feel like everybody deserves their moment in the spotlight, much like they got in this film. So let's go to Rusty. You know, Rusty is a little bit static. I mean, he just basically is a cool guy who's really good at crime and also good at building other people up. I feel like that was kind of where he was coming from. You know, he gives Linus the opportunity to replace Danny. And also, at the beginning of the movie, he's like getting all these teen heartthrobs to learn how to play poker, even though they're not learning at all.
Right.
But what really interested me about Rusty is that he's always eating.
Yes, he's always snacking. That was actually Brad Pitt's decision. He was like, yeah, I think that's something that this character is going to do. He's just always going to be snacking, always going to have some kind of food that he's going through because he's going through this stressful heist, whatever. And that's just his, I guess, way of getting through it. So
yes. And I've seen there's like some people have like tracked the calories that Brad Pitt has consumed on screen. And apparently the more calories he consumes on screen, the more money the movie makes on average.
Really?
So, okay. Yeah, and there's like a, I can link to a YouTube video in the description of this episode where somebody really breaks it down, but it's hilarious that Brad Pitt, like one of his skills as an actor is being good at eating on screen. And, and this movie is gotta be the prime example. He's eating all over the place.
Yeah, and I'll say it's not easy eating like fast food on camera. It's a gross thing that you're doing, and he's able to pull it off in a way. It's almost like, oh wow, look at Brad Pitt eating nachos or a cheeseburger. You're like, okay, that kind of makes him a little more normal. And okay, if Brad Pitt is gonna eat fast food like that, I guess it's not the worst thing when I do it. So
he looks awesome doing it. I definitely don't look like that while I'm eating fast food.
And I guess I don't know if I would necessarily call this a con per se, but I do think the fact that we are pretty much just now talking about Rusty kind of tells me that there's like a little left to be desired with him.
Agreed.
Where like you think of him as, yeah, he's like the sidekick. He's the number two character, but he also feels like he's not. Like he's just kind of there. I like completely forgot what his name was until at one point in the movie I was like, oh wait, yeah, his name is Rusty. Like he's just kind of he's not as big of a, as prominent of a character as you I feel like he's not as prominent of a character as you think he is in this film.
I agree he's kind of just there to be cool, and he does kind of I think that the characters that play less of a role are there to prop up the characters that do play a larger role. The whole conflict that's created where it's like, are you here for Tess or are you here for the money like the rest of us? Remember, you can't split Tess 11 ways.
Yep.
That conversation only happens because Rusty is so professional, one-track minded, right? So it helps us to deepen our knowledge of Danny because Rusty is there. And I think a few other characters work that way as well. Like Basher. Like Basher doesn't have, I mean, the Cockney accent really is a lot, but he kind of builds up our other characters by helping to move things along. Like when we originally have him there planning, he's like easily going to be able to disrupt and make chaos. But when the destruction of that of Ruben's hotel happens, it changes Basher's plan, right? And because Basher's, so that like gives us something that includes Ruben and then ties that into what Basher's job is. And then when Basher comes up with the pinch, now we have an opportunity for Linus to step up and say, okay, I want to be more involved. That whole scene is almost unnecessary because at the end of the day, Basher's going to do his Basher thing and cause the lights to go out. That's not really the point. It's to give us another opportunity for Linus to show us that Linus wants an opportunity to go do something, right? Also, it's where Yen breaks his hand. So it's like these other characters, while they might not give us more depth into who they are necessarily, they still get to play their part in kind of filling the blanks in and propping up the other characters, which I thought was good. It almost gives them this facade of depth where it seems like they're doing something. Like the Malloy twins. What did you think of them? Were they funny or were they annoying?
They were annoying, but they were crucial. They were fun in some capacity, but they were definitely a little too much at times. But I think you needed that. Like, you needed these two goofballs going back and forth to really be able to execute the plan. So I definitely have a little more to add on them at some point here, but I do think that the Malloy twins were kind of like you needed them in the group. Some things were funny, but I think for the most part it was very kind of cringe, like brotherly, like, all right, you guys are adults, what are you doing here?
I've definitely met those brothers where it's like, come on, guys, behave. Like, you can't leave you two alone. I don't know if it's really a legitimate issue. I would have brought it up in the cons if I felt that way, but one problem I had with the Malloy twins was they were showing their faces everywhere in the casino. This casino is famously monitored, and they're just walking around wearing different costumes, sure, but their faces are the same in every single costume, and I felt like that was a little bit too obvious. Now, let's be clear. If this movie was going to ratchet up the realism to that point, none of these guys are getting into the casino because they all went in there, learned the different rotations and like when the money moves around and all that other stuff. They all kind of surveyed the casinos before the heist. They all showed their faces. So if we were going to go to that level of realism, I don't think this movie can exist. So,
right.
But the reason I say this is I didn't feel like the Malloy twins' specialty really came into effect. We had the RC car at the beginning that kind of sets up the RC van at the end, a little setup and payoff. But that's it? That's their whole involvement? Basically, everything else they do doesn't have to do with automotive specialty at all. So it kind to me, I was like, that's a little bit boring. I feel like their specialty is not really used. What if they were like masters of disguise and their specialty was being able to pull off the disguises so that they can blend in and impersonate and be whoever they need to be? Again, not exclusive to them. Linus also disguises himself as a member of the Nevada Gaming Commission and everything else. So I don't know if this exactly works, but to me, they came across as a little bit undefined, more just goofballs than professional criminals.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, they were drivers. That's it. That's really, that was the big thing, and being able to do the RC control thing, which, you know, I think like anybody really could have done that. They just happened to work out as good brothers to get involved here. So
moving on to Ruben, former owner of the casino, and he bankrolls the operation. Really, I think he's there to establish the rivalry of Terry, and I think he does a good job of that.
Yes.
He's got kind of like the Caesar haircut.
Yep.
And
yep,
he's very Vegas royalty.
Very Vegas. Yeah, right. Very like, I was running things in the 70s in Las Vegas. Like, this is my town.
Yes.
And I'm just living off that, you know, the old times.
It's
today.
It's a little bit of world building. It feels like we're kind of dropped into this existing world where these brutal casino owners are at war with each other constantly, and this is just one battle in a larger war between you know, the established guys out there. So I liked Ruben for what he was. Also, you know, the part where Linus doesn't immediately go indoors and Ruben is like, come on, you're the chosen one, Linus. Your legacy is like calling you. So yeah, that was good. Yen, the amazing Yen. It's interesting because he's only been in Ocean's movies. I looked at his IMDb. There's four movies
right.
on
this
it.
Was his first experience as an actor.
Yes.
They were like, they watched a show of his and they're like, yeah, hey, you want to be in this movie and play this stuntman role? And he did it.
Oh,
so.
But he was so memorable.
His
acrobatic feats are one of the first things that came to mind when I thought about Ocean's 11. I was like, the part where he does a backflip is so cool. And it's like, I watched this movie with my fiance And when he does it for real, he does a backflip and he almost flips over.
Yeah.
It got an audible gasp from her. Like she's like, and I thought it was great. Same. I was like, yes, the amazing end. And then the part where he almost gets his face blown off, just
right.
He does so much with so little, which is just a microcosm of this film.
Well, and when I said the whole, every time it gets serious, you immediately hit with comedic relief. When they finally change the batteries and blow everything up and he comes out, he's like, what the fuck took you guys so long? The only thing he says in English in the whole movie. And it's like, dude, if they blew it up when they're supposed to, you'd be dead. So I thought it was so funny. Like, that was an easy laugh right there.
And then Frank, you know, played by the late Bernie Mac.
Yep. Ramon.
So funny. Yes. He's a laugh a minute when he's on screen. That scene between
I thought that he was going to be your favorite character just because I know you're a big Bernie Mac fan.
He
was up there for me. He just missed the cut, but it's like, you know, he's still in the top half for sure.
Just not enough of him.
Right. I think that's fair.
Like, I'm happy that he's the first one that Danny goes to see because I think they wanted to get Bernie Mac as much time to talk on screen. But I mean, really, the scene between him and Matt Damon when they're revealing who he actually is, that is all, that's what you got him for, and he delivered. Might as well call it White Jack. I mean, hilarious.
Yeah, right. That was,
So it's I love Bernie Mac, and I thought I could have used more, but I think I'll always say I could use more Bernie Mac. I thought he was fantastic.
That's fair. He definitely plays a prominent role. And the thing is, you only had so much screen time for all these guys.
Exactly. And the movie has to be economical with it. And honestly, I wouldn't change anything. I think they did a great job. Maybe a little bit less of the Malloy twins. But honestly, I wouldn't change anything. I think they give everybody the right amount of screen time. Livingston Dell gets his own mini heist when he goes in to set up the whole camera situation. I honestly didn't come across as the most likable to me, but he did come across as one of the most like realistic. He's kind of the glue holding this whole heist together with his ability to, the guy in the chair.
You need the tech guy. Exactly. Yeah.
So I mean that he was nervous, he was serious.
Yep.
And he was really good at what he does.
Yeah, right. I mean, when the guys, they were just moving around his cameras, he's like, you don't see me grabbing your gun and flashing around. It's like, all right, this is not a great one-for-one comparison, but okay.
And I think that's everybody. We talked about Danny, Rusty, Linus, Saul, the Malloy twins, Ruben, Yen, Frank, Basher, Livingston, Dell. I think we got them.
Yeah, I counted 11.
Okay.
So. And, nice work.
Okay. One more question for you, Corey.
Yes.
What do you think is the least believable aspect of the heist?
Yeah, so this was where I was saving coming back to the Malloy twins. I think the least believable aspect was the balloon scene. And so basically, Turk and Virgil get into a fight. The whole balloon boy, you know, the classic brother thing. The balloons blocking the camera for as long as they did to let Livingston get into the surveillance room, that wouldn't happen. They call it out immediately, and the guy's just trying to be like, break up the fight, stop the fight. He's not pulling the balloons away. That, to me, is the least believable aspect. I think there's a lot of things, but that is just simply not something that would happen. You can talk about the physics behind some of the stuff they did, but that just right there, knowing how casinos work, they just wouldn't let a camera just be unavailable because of balloons for as long as they were.
I think that's a good one. I think there's a lot of different ones you can pick, but the one I'll pick is the ceiling tiles in the room where Danny's getting beat up leading straight to the elevator shaft of the unbreakable vault. Come on, that's just too like easy. It's right. Like, well, who decided this? Because it's like, did you know where that room is going to be in the first place, Danny? That whole part to me was like, okay, Danny pulls all the strings and can see every possible future. Also, the other one was when they open the door to the vault room and the two guards who have one job are not looking at the door, and then they slide this like what looks like a disc that dissipates gas of some sort that knocks them both out, which I did think I liked because you hear one and then Linus is about to open the door, but then he's like, no, not yet. And then you hear the other one fall. But then they just walk in there too without like gas masks or anything. And it's like, does it dissipate that quickly that you guys don't have to worry about yourselves getting knocked out? So anyways, I think you, if you start nitpicking stuff like that, the whole movie is going to quickly fall apart because it's just not that serious. I think from a surface level, the heist does hold together really well and is even clever in the whole reveal. I liked the SWAT fake out. I felt like that was clever. It's cool. You couldn't have seen it coming, and it makes for a satisfying end to a very complicated heist.
Yeah, right. And that, I think that was really the big thing when Ruben goes through the whole stuff. And I mean, I guess also even when Saul is going through and like listing everything out, it's like, you just expect us to walk out of there with $150 million. And you're like, yeah, but how is that going to happen? You're just in the desert now. And then it's the SWAT trucks that end up being the thing that saved the day. Just out of nowhere. You're like, whoa, how did they do that? So,
yeah, I love how it's like they begin, they're like, here's exactly what we're going to do. But then they stop telling you the plan.
Yep.
And so you think you know what they're doing. And then they're able to surprise you there in the end. You know, that I thought that was really great. Like when Saul died, I was like, no, not Saul dying.
See, that was the one thing, is the way I think that he did such a good job of selling it. I can't remember the actor's name. I know he just recently passed away, but the whole time I was like, is he actually dying in real life? No, he's just nervous. But I'm like, when he is like in bed and couldn't get out, was he sick? Like, what was going on? He was just really struggling with it. And it kind of goes back to, this is it for him. Like, this is his big time moment, all these millions of dollars at stake.
Yeah, so. Carl Reiner.
Carl Reiner, yes.
And, no, I agree. They do such a good job of like hinting at his real life health problems. But
right,
then,
early in the movie.
They don't, again, they don't explicitly explain it, which they don't need to, but it's like maybe the tablets he was taking were the thing that were making him sweat and making him sick.
Yeah.
You know, it's like he was doing it intentionally. That's why when he was getting ready for it, he's like, okay, here I go. I'm about to make myself feel really sick, and I need to be in the right headspace to do that. You could look at it that way, or you can be like,
that is a good point.
I do feel sick, but I need to hold it together for my last performance. I think either one of those works in a really dramatic way. So just another reason why.
That's actually a good point. I didn't think of it as like an intentional sick thing. I thought it was just, he's sick. So.
Right. So again, another situation. I guess the reason I feel that way is because after that, he's fine.
he participates
in the other stuff, and then even has like his solemn moment there at the
Bellagio. Yeah, at the fountain.
So, okay. So those were some of the things that we thought were least believable. Corey, do you have anything else you want to say about this movie before we move on?
No, I think I'm ready to move on and talk about things in other fashion.
Okay, so. Well then let's talk about cool Easter eggs and fun facts. What do you got for us, Corey?
Yeah, so I have a lot of different things here, and I said before, a lot of it you can Google yourself, but we Googled it for you, so we can teach you. So the first thing I'm going to call out here, so I saw this tweet on my For You page a couple months ago, and it's like, I got to screenshot this. This is perfect. It's going to come back here. So this was from the Twitter account at Crane T. Nelson, originally tweeted out on January 18th, 2022. Someone screenshotted it in reply to another tweet about basically movie budgets. So he says, no movie should cost more than $85 million to make. Why $85 million? Because that's how much it costs to make Ocean's 11. You want $200 million to make your superhero movie? Is your movie going to be twice as good as Ocean's 11? I don't think so. Take a hike, pal. And I'm like, yeah, that's actually fair. Like, this movie's $85 million. I don't know that I've seen a whole lot of movies that are twice as good at that type of budget. Like, they go crazy. So definitely enjoy my superhero movies, but I think Ocean's 11 is a real life superheroes movie. So,
well, in the neighborhood of how much it cost to make this movie, apparently the entire cast took pay cuts.
Yes,
in order
to bring
this budget down. But still, I think
it made $450 million. So I think they more than made up for it in the end. So it's definitely a good. It was George Clooney's idea. He was very involved in it. Apparently, he was not a fan of the original Ocean's 11, which I have heard is not a great movie. It might have been completely George Clooney's review that I'm going off of, but as far as I know, it wasn't as well received as this remake 41 years later.
I did hear that. It has a similar aspect to it where it's a bunch of big names, but not a lot of those names are all that relevant to us today.
Right. It's Frank Sinatra and Sammy Davis and like the Rat Pack, but it's other names I go through. I'm like, I haven't heard of these guys. They don't last as well as the lead role, which Sinatra plays Danny Ocean, and this, so many other actors continue to play big roles. So do you have something you want to add?
Oh, yeah. Well, you mentioned that George Clooney kind of is the Danny Ocean of the cast of Ocean's 11.
Yes.
Because he was the first to join the cast, and then he got Pitt to sign on, and that kind of started the snowball of getting all these big names in there.
Yeah, he got Julia Roberts by sending her the script with a $20 bill and said, I heard you're the $20 woman, which is a $20 million woman. I don't know if $20 is really what sealed the deal, but she was definitely interested there. So initially, the Wilson brothers were going to play the Malloy brothers, Luke and Owen, but they were already committed to the Royal Tenenbaums, so they did not end up participating here. They ended up winning awards, but these guys ended up making a lot more money. So Casey Affleck, I think, was kind of known. Scott Caan, this was considered his breakthrough role. He was not really someone who was well established, but now he's known. Dano Williams from Hawaii Five-O, and Scott Lavin from Entourage. So he definitely is, like, everyone else is kind of established. Like, he is the one of the 11 that, like, he is a name. You see him now, you're like, oh, I know who that guy is. But when you first watched it in 2001, you probably didn't know who he was.
Right. And as much, I think they're fine. Again, I wouldn't necessarily change them, but I would love to have seen the Wilson brothers. I think that would have been hilarious.
Yes, they would have been a very fun time. I agree with that. So I already mentioned that Rusty snacking throughout the movie was Brad Pitt's idea. So one thing that I liked, and I didn't really look into this, this is my own personal Easter egg. So when they're first showing the shots of Las Vegas, the one hotel that you can see is the Stardust Resort and Casino. Now, this was a casino that opened in 1958, closed in 2006. And this is one of the casinos that was ran by Frank Lefty Rosenthal, who is the real life inspiration for Sam Ace Rothstein of Martin Scorsese's Casino.
Ah.
Might have just been a coincidence, but I like to think that that was kind of an ode to Casino, which was just a few years earlier. Another one where it's all about kind of like the seedy underworld of Las Vegas casinos. So,
wow, that is a really nice hand, like homemade Easter egg there, Corey. Only a Vegas guy like you would be able to connect those dots.
Right. Yeah, so I definitely enjoyed that. So one thing, we talked, this movie, So Las Vegas, it's basically a walking advertisement for Las Vegas and the Bellagio in particular. Steve Wynn, who is the owner of the Bellagio, at least was in 2001, was really good friends with producer Jerry Weintraub, and he basically gave the crew free reign to shoot at any time. Normally, that's not the case in Las Vegas movies. It's always there in like twilight hours, but they said, yeah, 30% of the casino floor is all yours whenever you need it. So he knew that this movie was going to be successful with all the lead names in it. And it definitely does a great job of advertising his hotel. So
it's kind
I'm
of
sure
funny
no regrets.
To make a movie, like to totally be on board with a movie about robbing you specifically. You know?
Right, right. Yeah, essentially, he was essentially the Terry Benedict. But I don't know if Steve Wynn himself is considered at all like Terry Benedict.
Well,
yeah,
even
that
if
is
it's
essentially
just robbing the establishment
or
of
just,
the Bellagio,
right, robbing
you
Bellagio
know?
Like, in general.
Come
yeah,
to
right.
Vegas and see if you can yes. do it. See if you can do your own Ocean's 11.
Yeah, I mean, I think they make it very clear just how difficult this is and that you're not going to be able to pull it off, but you know, maybe you could try. So kind of going to the boxing part of this. So the MGM Grand Garden Arena for the longest time was the home of major sporting events. It was the arena. All of the big top heavyweight prize fights were held there. T-Mobile Arena was opened in Las Vegas in 2016 with the intention of attracting professional teams. Las Vegas Golden Knights followed suit very quickly. That hosts so many events now. Any type of big basketball tournament, like Pac-12 conference championships, are always held there. They have lots of NBA preseason games come through to Las Vegas. So no longer MGM Grand Garden Arena, though they did host the inaugural All Elite Wrestling event in 2019 and the WWE Money in the Bank pay-per-view match in 2022. So away from boxing into wrestling, still gets a little bit of playtime there, but it is not today a big boxing event. So kind of also talking about this, so in this boxing scene you can see Henry Silva and Angie Dickinson in the crowd very briefly. They're the only two members from the original Ocean's 11 in 1960. Most of the cast member had already passed away. This was their final and penultimate appearances on screen, so very cool they were able to be in it. And then another thing, so this is kind of interesting. Lennox Lewis and Vladimir Klitschko are the two boxers in the movie. Apparently, Lennox Lewis had an actual fight that he was training for, and his manager dropped him because he did this movie and then lost the fight in a big upset. And his manager was like, why did you do this? The 2 days you spent doing this movie cost you in training. So
wow. That's
yeah, right. And they actually had like a big lawsuit court battle. I think it's more than just that, but this was one thing that was involved.
Wait, who
there.
Had the court battle? The boxer and his manager?
Lennox Lewis. And yeah, I didn't write down the name because I didn't know how to pronounce it, but his boxing manager.
Okay, I thought he was going to try to sue the movie for letting him be
no,
in
no,
it.
No, 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 not the movie. No, basically saying like the movie more
I was powerless
or less,
to,
hindered his
like,
career.
Say no to George Clooney. Like, I'm right. suing.
Right. Well, and then his manager is like, what? You think that Julia Roberts is just going to like, hey, like, yeah, thanks for being in this movie. Like, let's hang out sometime. Like, that's not what happened.
Especially because, like, they didn't really build up the fighters. Like, they were on TV a couple times.
Right.
But it wasn't like they were like, this really interesting boxer versus this.
Right. They
really
didn't say the names,
boxer.
But
yeah.
they were real life boxers. And I don't know why they didn't highlight them. Like, you don't see, they didn't get credited in the actual movie as it was going on as Klitschko versus Lewis. It was just number one boxer versus number two boxer.
He should have kept his priorities straight. It's just a theme in Ocean's 11. You know, you have to have your priorities. You care more about boxing or do you care more about being in this movie? Do you care more about tests or do you care more about money? You know, really, that's what it boils down to, I think.
Right. That's a good point. Priorities for sure. And the final thing I wrote down, I thought it was very funny when the van, they shoot it down and they get the money back. And it was actually just the prostitute cards that they hand out on the street in Las Vegas. If you've been to Las Vegas, you would just think that's just everywhere. That is like the currency in the city with how many are just littered all throughout the Las Vegas Boulevard Strip.
That is so funny that you said that because that was my like handcrafted Easter egg was that.
Yeah.
This is just another example. Like you said, this movie's kind of a walking advertisement for Las Vegas. Those stripper adverts or the prostitute adverts are everywhere. And I've only seen them in Vegas, so that was such a fun way to be like, haha, Vegas fake out.
Yes, right. Hey, shout out to Sherry. I'm sure that she was very popular after appearing in this movie.
All right. Well, unsurprisingly, we did actually have a lot of the same Easter eggs, so I'll just go with the ones you haven't said yet. One of them is that it took several takes for them to shoot the scene in which Rusty and Linus are spying on Tess, the one that I mentioned earlier that I thought was funny. And through shooting that scene, Brad Pitt ended up eating 40 shrimp.
Yes. Oh, I did read that. Yeah. I meant to write that down with the snacking piece. That is just kind of gross. I like shrimp, but that's a lot of shrimp.
I'm allergic to shrimp. This amount of shrimp would probably kill me.
Yeah, it probably would.
Another one. The cast did gamble during off hours. Probably another reason why they were so okay with them shooting the movie here, because those movie stars got a lot of money. And there's a disagreement between who won the most money, because George Clooney says Matt Damon won the most money, and Matt Damon says Brad Pitt won the most money. Clooney, meanwhile, managed to lose 25 hands of blackjack in a row.
It's insane.
Just another thing me and George Clooney have in common is losing at blackjack a lot.
25 in a row, though. That's so bad. I don't know how that you do that. Like you just have to not know what you're doing to just not accidentally stumble into like a blackjack or something. So
right. Statistically unlikely, but somehow the certain outcome when I step up to the table. Steven Soderbergh said of this film that it was an opportunity to give audiences, quote, pleasure from beginning to end. He wanted it to be, quote, a movie that you just surrender to without embarrassment and without regret. He nailed that. Like,
absolutely.
If that was the goal, he absolutely hit it right on the head, which I think is super impressive. And again, like we said, if that's what you want, this movie gives it to you in the best possible way. Like, if you're going to compare this movies that have the same goal, like they're doing the same thing, this might be the best one.
I completely agree. I think that's the best way to describe it, is just you compare it to like-minded movies and it's going to come out on top most of the time.
Absolutely. And last one I have for you, Bruce Willis was originally cast as Danny Ocean, but he had to pull out due to scheduling conflicts, and then he makes a cameo appearance in Ocean's 12.
Ocean's 12, yeah.
I feel like having George Clooney instead is a huge step up. I love Bruce Willis,
agree.
But for this role, I can't see anybody but George Clooney playing Danny Ocean.
Yep. Yep. I think George Clooney was the perfect casting for this movie. So definitely glad that it worked out that way.
Absolutely. Honestly, in my youth, this is the movie that made me realize that George Clooney is epic. So, yeah.
If they wanted to make a Las Vegas heist movie that was an action thriller, then that's when you cast Bruce Willis.
Yeah.
If they're like, we're going to make Die Hard, but a Las Vegas casino, then yes, Bruce Willis would have been perfect. That's not what they're trying to do. So that's why Clooney was the guy.
So. We'll go to Vegas, play some poker, have a few laughs, you know, running around on the carpeted floor of the casino and without shoes on. That would be Bruce Willis. Yeah, I agree. Okay, so those are our cool Easter eggs. Let's move on to our quotable moments. And what do you got for us, Corey?
Yeah, so I think that the first moment that makes sense to start with is the one that kind of really sets up what this movie title is.
Saul makes 10. 10 ought to do it, don't you think? You think we need one more? You think we need one more? All right, we'll get one more.
Yeah, so visually, Rusty is slumped over at the bar, not responding to Danny as he continues to ask, you want one more, all right, get one more, and he does blink, so that's kind of the, yes, we need 11, and this is that moment where you have it in a lot of these movies where you're like, Leonardo DiCaprio mean, oh, that's it, pointing at the TV, that's
whistling,
why the title.
Whistling, snapping, pointing at the screen.
yes, that's why the title of this movie is Ocean's 11, not Ocean's 10, because you got 11 total, so. Yeah.
I think you can categorize this under like the witty, funny dialogue. It's subtle, but also really on the nose, and it's memorable. It is that moment where you say, yep. This is it. This is Ocean's 11. He's the 11th one. Right. It also sets up Linus. I think part of the anticipation for what Linus will become comes from this being the thing. It's like he's the final piece of the puzzle.
Yes, he is the 11th guy that brings it all together and makes this heist what it needs to be. So,
okay. Well, what about your next quote for us, Corey?
Yes. So my next quote, this was one that when I was watching it, at first, I kind of watched through the whole thing and I was like, wait, I need to go back. I need to take time to write this down. It's a long kind of conversation. It's a great moment with Saul. And I think that this is just something that just kind of really, really puts into words what Danny Ocean is trying to do.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. Say we get into the cage and through the security doors there and down the elevator we can't move and past the guards with the guns and into the vault we can't open.
Without being seen by the cameras.
Oh, yeah, sorry, I forgot to mention that.
Yeah, well, say we do all that. We're just supposed to walk out of there with $150 million in cash on us without getting stopped?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
I love the long pause as they all look around the room and everyone's like, yeah, when you say it like that, what do you mean? And then Danny's just, yeah. Like he just has it in his head. We're going to pull this off. It's going to work. There's not going to be a problem. And all of the others, it's fair to be skeptical. And of course, Saul, who's someone who, like we said, has not had any success close to this. And you understand his nerves going into it. I think that, you know, as the movie kind of builds up with this character, he starts to get a little more confident. I think the big thing was the, you know, are you ready? If you ask me that, you're not going to wake up in the morning. But in this scene, it's like, yeah, you put it like that, it just sounds so ridiculous. And they managed to pull it off. And in the end, it's kind of like, you know what? It does make sense when you put it all together, knowing what they did. But in the beginning, you're like, how are they possibly going to do this? So
yes, they do such a good job of setting it up where they're like, the last thing you could possibly do, this is literally impossible. And we're not even going to tell you necessarily how we're going to do it yet, but we will walk out of there. Something that we've seen before is not possible in Vegas. It's a lethal way to exit the casino is with a bunch of the casino's money. So, yeah, I thought that was great. And also, Saul, just going back to the whole movie theater or like the creating a movie together thing, Saul's just the lead actor. He's just doing whatever the director says. And the director says, we're going to make a hit. And Saul says, all right, I'll play my part.
Yes, and I think that's actually a good transition into the final quote I have provided. This is one from Rusty, and we kind of talked about foreshadowing with Saul and the whole betting on the horse with the betting on the dog that has they break late. Is that the phrase? The dog breaks late.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was foreshadowing with Saul breaking late by having his big moment at the end of his career. And I think that this scene or this quote from Rusty is it's like, oh, this makes so much sense when you go back and look at it and break it down later.
You'd need at least a dozen guys doing a combination of cons.
What do you think?
Off the top of my head, I'd say you're looking at a Boski, a Jim Brown, a Miss Daisy, two Jethros, and Leon Spinks. Not to mention the biggest Ella Fitzgerald ever.
Yeah, so I'll fully admit I didn't know a lot of those references, but I happened to stumble upon some Quora and Reddit posts that broke it down, and I think it makes sense to talk about this and really kind of understand what Rusty was foreshadowing and what Rusty and Danny were able to put together. So the first thing, a Boski. Ivan Boski was a big-time trader on Wall Street who got caught committing insider trading. And this basically is supposed to represent Saul playing Lyman Zerga. He's a con man, and that gets Terry to open the vault, the whole insider trading piece here. So I think that's really what they were going for. You need someone to basically get on the inside to pull this off.
Okay.
So Jim Brown. So there's two different ways to look at this. Jim Brown, he was an NFL football player for the Cleveland Browns in the 1950s and 60s. He dealt with a lot of racism. He was a very anti-racism activist. He's also just an NFL player, a large black man, very intimidating. So this is Frank Catton, and you can really look at it in two ways. One theory is people talking about just the intimidation he provided when he was getting the deal on the van. And I think you can also talk about the scene with him and Linus when he's basically calling out the racism and saying that's why he's being fired from his casino job. So I think it makes sense to say that Frank is the Jim Brown, is the only black man here. I think it's just a matter of what angle they're really going for.
Yeah, I could see him more being the getting the van, maybe, just because I don't see how being a guy who points out perceived racism being like a role that's established for heists. You know,
right. It was one of those things. It worked out in that sense. I think it was more just a distraction to continue to get Terry in this room and just go back and forth, create this confrontation, have Terry feel like he is there, like he's got to make sure that these two guys don't kill each other or Frank doesn't kill Linus.
Yeah.
And I know that Jim Brown has definitely had some cases where some people think that he was maybe a little too quick to point out racism. Like, he was a very controversial person in his life, just recently passed away. So that's, I think, kind of why it kind of ties together with him.
Okay.
So Miss Daisy, this is an obvious reference to the movie Driving Miss Daisy, who was a woman who had a personal chauffeur. And I think just the whole idea of like the getaway truck, whether you want to talk about the getaway SWAT truck or even the driving when I can't remember if it's Virgil or Turk, but whichever one of them, Casey Affleck's character was doing the remote control with the van. So those are two different instances. You had to have a getaway driver at various points, even just the van when they were getting the power grid thing, the pinch. So
that makes a lot of sense to me that the driver would be the Miss Daisy. But well, what does that make Jethro?
So Jethro was a character from Beverly Hillbillies who I guess he was just the butt of many jokes, just like this really simple man who I guess he made fun of himself as much as he was made fun of by others. So I think it's a clear reference to the Malloy brothers as the two Jethros, the two guys just, you know, being dumb and stuff and creating distractions in their own ways, being able to be part of that role. Of course, with the balloons and, you know, just the getaway. Yeah,
Jethro was definitely a big personality on the Beverly Hillbillies. And I actually think he also drove their car.
All right. Well, there you go. That works out really well.
I could definitely see them being the Jethros.
Yeah. So Leon Spinks, he was a boxer who unexpectedly upset Muhammad Ali in 1978. you have the boxing fight, the unexpected event, the power going out, creating all the chaos.
Oh, interesting.
So,
okay.
Yes. And then the final thing here, the Ella Fitzgerald. So this is one that the original post wasn't sure the connection, but I think it's pretty clear. So Memorex was a computer tape producer that had a series of television commercials in the 1970s where Ella Fitzgerald sang a note that shattered glass, and the tape recording playback did the same thing. This led to the company's tagline, "Is it live or is it Memorex?" Terry was watching video of the money being stolen from his vault, believing it to be live, before realizing the Bellagio logo was not on the floor and the active robbery video he was watching was actually staged. So is it live or is it Memorex?
That's cool. I like that one a lot.
Yep. So
a lot of meaning in one just comma delimited list there.
Right.
Pretty impressive stuff from Rusty. I did like that, though, because, again, it makes them seem like seasoned criminals to just have little lingo that only they get because they do crimes all the time. They're always building crews. So
right.
I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, off the top of my head.
Yeah, just spitballing here, but we need two Jethros.
Right. He just gets like half of the crew just off of that. So
that's fantastic. Okay, well, that is the end of our quotable moments, and it's also going to bring us to the end of our conversation on Ocean's 11, as we do at the end of every episode of Affable Chat. We'll now deliver our ratings, and we'll have our guest go first. Corey, what rating do you want to give this film?
Yeah, so as tempting as it is to be boring and just go with 11 out of 10, I did come up with something better. I was going to call this out in my prose originally. I was like, let me save it for here. I give this movie all reds, which according to Topher Grace is the best hand at poker. I loved his his little cameo.
That's hilarious. I give this movie a trunk full of advertisements for strippers / escorts in Las Vegas. It's a hallmark of your visit there. You're going to end up with at least a handful of those. And this movie has definitely earned a whole trunk full, some of them on fire and definitely floating around.
Absolutely.
So there you go. Ocean's 11. Corey, you are so right. We're long overdue for another movie review with you. Hadn't even done one this decade. That seems like a crime. We're almost halfway through the decade. So, and we've collaborated so much, between our two podcasts. So I'm happy that you're back here viewing movies with me on Affable Chat. Tell the people how they can find you.
Yep. So I have my own podcast. He's Done It, a mostly sports podcast that I do with my co-host Brian. The mostly is some episodes we'll try to do things that aren't sports. Others, it's just 100%, just depending on what's going on. So definitely a lot of conversations around the NFL offseason, March Madness, NBA playoffs, Stanley Cup playoffs. Those are coming up. We're big football fans, but we definitely like to branch out and talk about other sports and just other things. We like to have fun with it. So you can find us wherever you get your podcasts at He's Done It Pod on Instagram. And yeah, so, and I'm at cnavantny915 on Instagram if you want to find me personally.
Yeah, and I'm on He's Done It pretty regularly as well.
Yep.
Talking sports and making sure to inject pop culture references as much as I can. And so we really enjoy our cross collaborations here between Affable Chat and He's Done It. All right, Corey. Well, that's it for Ocean's 11. Once again, thank you for joining me. What's next on Affable Chat, Corey?
So you will be reviewing the movie Bridesmaids, which I'm very excited to listen to.
Yes, it's honestly, it's almost the antidote to Ocean's 11 because this is a ensemble cast film with a bunch of women as opposed to Ocean's 11, like we talked about, which it just flunks the Bechdel test. So we're excited about that. The next time you hear me on Affable Chat, I will be married. So that's also why we wanted to do Bridesmaids. So very excited about that happening. So that's what's coming up next.
Subscribe to Affable Chat on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts.
AffableChat.com is your new favorite website on the internet. There you can find the latest from us and all our social accounts, including Instagram. That's really the place where we post. Or even our email address at AffableChat@gmail.com.
If you like this episode, then tell a friend about it. All you have to say is, Vegas's biggest high rollers all listen to Affable Chat.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And Terry Benedict comes up and shakes their hand, and he's like, I can tell this guy's been listening to Affable Chat, so you want to make sure you're one of those people. That's going to do it for this episode for Affable Chat. I'm Benjamin.
I'm Corey.
Thanks for listening.